history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, right there where you live, there are stories, sometimes untold stories, that we'll all be better off for hearing. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and yes, we really can be inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to talk about what was unfolding 75 years ago this week. But I also want to point you forward in time to a couple of opportunities you have to meet some of the hometown heroes you've heard on this show. I have all of this information linked online for you at hometownheroesradio.com as well. But if you're a let me grab a pen and a paper person like I am, go ahead and do that. And in a moment, I'll give you some details about events coming up the next couple of weekends on November 2nd and November 9th. Today's program is going to feature a recipient of America's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. Because what was happening in France's Vosges Mountains 75 years ago right now was one of the most heroic endeavors of World War II. In fact, had you been in Bruyères, France this week, you would have seen a parade commemorating the 75th anniversary of that town's liberation by the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Part of the effort to rescue what has become known as the Lost Battalion, a rescue that came at an incredibly heavy cost. Many of the 21 Japanese-American veterans to be awarded the Medal of Honor for their actions in World War II participated in that rescue, and four of them received their Medals of Honor specifically for their contributions to saving the Lost Battalion. So you're going to hear the reflections of one of those Medal of Honor recipients today, as well as another of the more than 800 casualties produced in an effort to rescue fewer than 300 men. You'll also hear from one of the members of the Lost Battalion who owes his life to those Nisei soldiers who rescued him. But before we go back in time, now that you have your pen and paper, here are those events I wanted to let you know about. If you're a regular listener, you might remember hearing about photographer Zach Coco and his Pictures for Heroes project. I told you that when he was ready to release his book as the culmination of years of photographing and interviewing vets, that I was going to let you know. And that time has come. In Los Angeles on November 9th, some of the World War II vets featured in the book will be on hand for a book release party and gallery exhibit of those photos at Hubble Studios. That's at 545 South Clarence Street in L.A., and if you're in that area, I really hope you can make it. And I want to say congrats to Zach. I know his labor of love will be a blessing to many, especially the families of all those veterans. Also, the weekend before that and a little further north, Fresno, California is gearing up for the 100th year of a Veterans Day parade that is now considered the largest in the nation. The annual gala fundraiser for the parade will be held on Saturday, November 2nd, and three gentlemen whose stories of survival you've heard on Hometown Heroes are going to be guests of honor. Gordon Scott, Albert Henderson, and Bob Cole all survived the sinking of their respective ships during World War II. They will be recognized in front of a crowd that gets to hear from Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek, who co-authored the New York Times bestseller, Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. Sarah and Lynn will be signing books there. It's going to be an incredible evening in Clovis, California, and you can order your tickets by calling 559-289-3417. I'm going to give you that phone number one more time, 559-289-3417. There will also be a free screening the night before, thanks to the Clovis Veterans Memorial District, of Sarah Vladek's acclaimed documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. Sarah will be on hand for that as well at 6 o'clock on November 1st. And again, all of that info is accessible online at hometownheroesradio.com. If you enjoy this program, I'm pretty confident you'll enjoy any or all of those events. And now, let's get on to the rescue of the Lost Battalion, which took place 75 years ago this week in the Vosges Mountains in eastern France. We've heard from a few folks over the years who were involved in that situation, including Lawson Sakai, who was wounded four times during his service with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Lawson is celebrating his 96th birthday this week in Morgan Hill, California. But the situation he was in when marking his 21st birthday in the Vosges Mountains 75 years ago did not give him much to celebrate.
The weather was so bad, and of course we didn't have winter clothing, and we were soaking wet from the rain, and the hills were muddy. We're in the Vosges Mountains, the thickest forest that we'd ever been in. The Germans had the 88-millimeter anti-aircraft weapon, lowered it down, and started shooting it at the infantry. That sound of that 88 going off and exploding, that shrill sound coming, is something that I've never heard duplicated in movies or anything. It's just mind-shattering. You know, when it comes directly at you, wow, you know, it just, the sound itself is enough to blow you apart. But when it would hit these trees, branches would come off. Sometimes half of a tree would come falling, weighing maybe 1,000 pounds. A lot of guys got crushed. And the morning that I got hit, the 28th of October, we're going to mount a real strong attack at daybreak. And the Germans probably sensed that we were, because we had a big battle on the 27th. We gained the high ground. We dug in as best we could. That early that morning, the barrage came in, probably lasted 20, 25 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe 100 rounds, just bang, 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 just continuously. We were pinned down. You couldn't move. We had a lot of casualties right at that time. And, of course, when I got it, well, I thought I was dead, so I was out of it. But
I imagine you had probably had some close calls before that.
Yeah, I got wounded twice in Italy and then once before in France. So, but they weren't that bad, you know.
Well, define that, because you say, yeah, I got wounded once. Well, yeah, and most people have never been wounded, period. So when you say weren't that bad, what do you mean?
You know, I got patched up and I could go back a day or two. Mm-hmm. But the last time, the shrapnel that got me in, if it came straight through, it would have blown a hole through me, but it came in at an angle, so it wrapped around in my ribs here. Oh, that was really painful. It just, you know, a red-hot piece of steel in there, and it just, your body just gives way. You just curl up, and you can't breathe, and I was sure I was dead. I remember I told the medic, just let me die right there. And he pumped me full of morphine, because when I woke up, I was on a train, on a litter. They were going to the American Hospital in Dijon, which is not too far away, for surgery. And I don't know how I survived that one. But guys were getting killed left and right. You know, mostly the barrage from the artillery, just a awful shattering of not only the artillery shell, but the tree trunks and limbs coming down. In Italy, we had a few vineyards, a few olive orchards. Most of the hills were bare. Got to France and eastern France, and all of a sudden, this huge forest that we had to go through. The Germans were already entrenched, dug in, so we had to go into the forest, dig them out.
You're going into a meat grinder.
Yeah.
What about your recovery? How long did it take to recover from those wounds?
About 3 months, but not too long after October 30, when the 211 men were rescued, Dahlquist pushed the 442nd for another 4 or 5 days before he let them come off the line.
Right.
We had so few men left. I think I Company had 8 out of 250 or so.
8 out of 250.
Yeah. I think our company, E Company, had probably the most. From what I heard, we had about 40 men left. But the 442nd really couldn't do much in it. They're just depleted. So they were sent to southern France between Italy and France, and a hillside where, like the Maginot Line, they had fortresses built. And the duty was to guard the French-Italian border and the port cities of Cannes, Nice, and that area, patrol all of that. They called it the Champagne Campaign because there was very little battle going on, but there was a few. My One of my friends, Sakamoto from the Valley, he got killed there. I think he's about the only one that was killed during that time. Mm-hmm. And the 442nd was there like from the middle of November till April. And that's the time when all these young kids now, the Army changed the designation back to 1A because of what the 442nd was doing. Mm-hmm. So they made them all eligible for the draft and for being drafted. And they were being trained at Camp Shelby. So after about 6 months, they were sent over, and they came in en masse to fill up the 442nd again.
Right. It needed a lot of filling up because of how devastated it was. With those 3 months of recovery for you, were there ever days where you weren't sure you were going to make it? Or you weren't sure you were going to be yourself again?
No, I was in good shape after the surgery. A little painful, of course. But
did you have broken ribs?
Nothing broke. It just... a lot of muscle tear, which is pretty bad.
And there are a lot of internal organs inside your rib cage. I mean, there's a lot of damage that could have been done there.
It didn't go in. It didn't come through. It went around. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, just luck.
The angle was everything.
Yeah. Just luck.
Was it luck or was somebody looking out for you?
I don't know. And you see guys that... they get hit square in the head with a bullet. Oh, jeez.
Well, here's the other thing that strikes me. Your injury, which almost killed you. I mean, we're talking inches probably from killing you. But had you not been wounded that day, 442 has a couple more days of combat before they liberate the Lost Battalion, and a lot more guys died in those two
days.
That's right. Is it possible that getting wounded when you did could have saved your life?
Very, very likely. From what some of the guys told me, the day that I got hit, after the barrage, they made their way forward, but they had a tough time. That was the 29th, 28th, the next day, the 29th. They could hear firepower, but it was not coming at them. So they knew that must be where the Americans were trapped because the Germans were shooting at them. Mm-hmm. So now, the incentive is to get going. They knew they had to get going. So the 29th and 30th, when they broke through on the 30th, it was really a bloody, what we call bonsai charges.
And we're going to hear from someone whose actions in one of those bonsai charges would eventually earn him our nation's highest decoration, the Medal of Honor. We'll hear some more from Lawson Sakai before we're done as well. And also, one of the men from that Lost Battalion who owes his life to those courageous go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd. Dig deeper into the history through the links I have for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as a season of 75th anniversaries continues. In less than a year, we'll reach the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. In our nation's capital this week, the National World War II Memorial had a moving ceremony commemorating 75 years since the biggest naval battle in the history of the world, the Battle of Leyte Gulf. But we're focusing today on something else that happened 75 years ago this week. The Rescue of the Lost Battalion. Between 200 and 300 soldiers, nearly all of them Caucasian, from the 36th Infantry Division, who were surrounded by German forces with supplies running low. Other units had tried to reach them but failed, so the task arrived at the feet of the go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, young Americans of Japanese ancestry who at the start of the war had been denied the privilege of serving on the basis of their heritage. Many of them had families locked up behind barbed wire by the very government they were now risking their lives for. The Rescue of the Lost Battalion is their most famous achievement, partly because it came at such a heavy cost. More than 800 of the Nisei soldiers were either wounded or killed, and saving a fraction of that number in the Lost Battalion. You've heard one of those Purple Heart stories. Now we'll hear another from a man who also received the Medal of Honor. Joe Sakato passed away 4 years ago at the age of 94. But when he wore that exclusive decoration around his neck, he did so as a tribute to all his fellow Nisei veterans, especially those who never came home.
I signed up for the Air Force, and the draft card says 4C, enemy alien. I said, what do you mean enemy alien? I'm an American. I'm born and raised here. No, your draft card says 4C, can't take you. But it so happened that the 100th Battalion was Territorial Guards of Hawaii. They rounded them up and sent them to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, and took the basic training, went over to Africa to join General Mark Clark, and then they went into Sicily and went into Anzio, and Anzio to Mount Cassino. It was a church on top of a hill, and they were supposed to take that hill. It's a church, and they didn't want to bomb it. And every time they would go up, they would get shot. So they became known as the Purple Heart Battalion. General Mark Clark said, we need more soldiers like this. So then Roosevelt signed a decree that we could join the Army. Therefore, the 442 was formed. All the residents volunteered from the camps, and then the Hawaiians and the pineapple fields came to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, formed the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and went overseas to join the 100th Battalion in Italy. Then I said, well, I'm going to join the Air Force again, and got to Camp Blanding and looking for the airplanes, and they, where's the airplanes? What are we? No, you're not in the Air Force, you're in the infantry. The 100th Battalion's replacement. You're the replacement. So I became an infantryman.
So this was not by choice. And a lot of the guys that ended up in the 442nd volunteered to go there because their families were in internment camps and they wanted to prove that they were every bit as American as anybody else. That wasn't your motivation. You're trying to go in the Air Force. They say, wait a second, you're Japanese American. We're sticking you with the rest of them. Is that pretty much how it happened?
That's how it happened. So I became an infantryman.
And how did you take that? Because I'm sure you'd heard about the kinds of things they were doing and the casualties that they'd suffered. I mean, the nickname Purple Heart Battalion kind of says it all, right?
Right. Hear the sound of that, and I said, oh, my gosh. I'm stuck here now. I was signed that I would go to war. Next thing you know, I was on board ship. My brother was a first draftee. In 1939, he was drafted, and he was in Fort Ord, California, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. He had to go back in to inland to Missouri area, and he had to take his basic training over again. So that's when I joined the Army. I had joined the first draftees, had their basic training. So I joined them, and we went to Camp Shelby, and from there we went overseas and joined. I joined the E Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Platoon, and then my brother was in, joined the 100th Battalion, became Baker Company. From there on, we went on board ships and headed for France. In France, we ended up in the near the Vosges Mountains of the Swiss border and the German border, foothills of the Swiss Alps, and climbing those hills is like 45-degree angle, and I had to pull on tree roots and pull myself up. Somebody else would take my pack, and somebody else. I was the last one up the hill, and when we got up top of the hill, this is going to be our first day of battle, and I was talking with one of my friends from Washington. We sat there, and we didn't know what incoming or outgoing was. When these veterans from the 442s of the 100 were fighting in Italy, they came back. I hear this, oh. Then the guy says, oh, that's outgoing. Okay, next, we're talking around, and then pretty soon, boom. I picked myself up about 15 feet, 10 feet away. I got a nick in my wrist, and then in my foot, I had another nick. But I looked down, and I see my friend laying down, face down, and I turned him over, and a shrapnel crazy jugular vein, and the blood was squirting out every time his pulse was beat. It was just stream of blood the size of a pencil would come out. And I'm trying to, my wound was nothing. So I was putting sulfur on his wound and put a pad on it and putting it too hard, and he couldn't breathe. And I had to let go, and blood was still squirting out. If I lost too much blood, he was the first to die on me.
And that was your very first day of combat?
First day of combat. The other veterans, they knew what's going on. But for me to get blown up and then see something, see my friend squirting blood, bleeding, I couldn't help him without choking him. And then I said, well, this is not for me. I don't know what I'm doing here. But we had to go. So we finally had to climb this hill and moving forward to town of Brewers. And the 3rd Battalion was down the bottom in the valley heading for Brewers. And then we heard house-to-house combat. They were fixed bayonets. So as we was marching towards the other end of the hill, the explosion goes off the top of the ridge that we were following, landmines. So we had to get on our stomach and pull out our bayonets and probe for landmines on it, inch by inch. What if I hit the trigger of the landmine? Holy mackerel. Boom. Another mine went off. Some at the top of the ridge. Well, we traveled on top of the ridge so we could look down to the left side and look down on the right-hand side. So as we traveled, they had these landmines put up. Then we finally got those out of the way, and then we got down to the end of the hill and we're looking down at this town of Brewers, and we see a tank, German Tiger tanks, going out. Hooray, they're leaving. Then he got out in the middle of the field and he turns around, and that's funny, his barrel is facing us. And next thing I hear, boom. Then I see a ring of smoke on the end of the barrel of the tank, and then pow, hit the tree behind us. He was shooting at us. We had to run on the other side and try to dig in about 6 inches and hit tree roots and rocks. And I had to crawl into my helmet, and I said, what am I getting into now? Oh, my God. Then we finally took that hill, went to the next hill, took another hill, and we got another one. And we got up early in the morning, and they chased the Germans off this one hill. And I chased them all the way down to the bottom of the hill, and the sergeant says, come back. So I was heading back, and the German is shooting at me, and I'm shooting back at him. And then I go up, try to get back up the hill, and I go about 10 feet, and I got to rest, go 10 more feet and rest. When I got on top of the hill, nobody was there. They thought I had joined them, and they all headed back downhill. Their eyes didn't know which way was our lines.
So you were all alone?
I was all alone by myself. And I got down, I got to the south end, the east end, left end of the hill, and I saw a big bush and 3 feet high, and I crawled inside that bush and put some branches on top of my face and nose. And I stayed there for a couple hours, and then German patrol comes by. Oh, my God. 2 more hours goes by. And well, it's now 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. I see our helmet, and I said, oh, that's how. Hey, what company is this? The guy wanted to shoot me because I didn't know the password. He says, I've been up this hill for 6 hours, and I don't know where the password is now. The F Company. So they took me back and got down. As soon as I got down the hill, got the rest of the company. Captain says, 3rd Platoon, you got to go up and see this colonel. Well, I just got to join the company. Well, you got to go. So we go up. One fellow was writing up a citation for that hill because we had taken that hill in 2 hours, an hour and a half. He was writing his 3rd Platoon. So he had to join us. He put all the information in his pocket, and we get up to see this colonel, and the colonel says he wanted to see where his men were. This is the 36th Division, Texas unit, and the Howley outfit. And we go out and see somebody chopping wood on this side of the hill and somebody's chopping wood on the other side of the hill. And then we go up about 1,000 yards. Oh, sure enough, there's men were dug in, the foxholes and everything. Then the lieutenant there says, go see where the Germans are at. Why should we go see where the Germans? Why can't they go see where the Germans are at? They didn't have orders. What do you mean they didn't have orders? So we go up the Gulf, another 500 yards, and German machine gun. We hit the ground. I rolled over to the left, got behind a bush. Guy from Pueblo, Colorado was on my left side. He was out in the open. Ben Masoka was writing up a citation. He was on my right side of my... He was out in the open. And the guy named Friday on the other side of him, he was out in the open. George put up on the left side. He looked up, first one to get to. A sniper, German sniper, had telescopic sights with crosshair. Pow! Right through the temple. First one to go. Then Ben on the other side, he didn't have his helmet strapped on. Pow! He decreased his temple. Blood just come out, and then the helmet flew right way back. Then Friday, he looks up. He got shot. So all three guys got shot and looking for me, and I'm behind this bush, and he couldn't see me. I had to go back, and I, for just to see where their own troops were, we had to go and find where the Germans were. We get shot. We lose three men just for nothing.
So it sounds like the message that you're getting is you guys were expendable.
That's what we were. General Dahlquist was, kept pushing. You got to move. You got to move. That's why the 141st unit of the Lost Battalion got surrounded, because they went too fast. They were moving too fast, and the rest of the 142nd and 403rd could not rescue them. So it was up to Lost 442 to rescue the Lost Battalion. We're on this side of the hill. We'll cross the railroad tracks, and we get this order. They just pointed out that one hill, 617. It's a big rocky ledge, cliffs, and then the rest of the mountain comes down. And we had to take that hill, and how are we going to get on top of that hill? He says, well, we go around it, but we have to chase the Germans off first. So we went on trucks, and we went behind the 7th Army, was fighting the Germans. And we went behind them and got on the back side of this hill. But we stayed on the west side of the hill down below, and at half step at a time we marched towards this cliff area. And when we took us all night to get up so far, we got to the area. At dawn, we started our attack. Now we were behind the Germans. We surrounded the Germans, and the Germans had to get out of their foxholes and went east to the east side. And then they joined the troops that was fighting the 3rd Battalion that was going into the valley. And we finally got them down and around there. We jumped. Then artillery came in, the Germans and artillery, and so we had to jump in the Germans' foxholes. And then we waited, and pretty soon the artillery stopped. There's going to be a counterattack. So the Germans called, radioed the troops that were fighting the 7th Army to come across, and they came across. Now they came in the same area that we had come in. Now the Germans were behind us. We were being surrounded again. They were trying to chase us out of their own foxholes. And we got out so far, and then I told one of the fellows, watch out for the machine gun. So he looks up and he says, where? And he got shot. When he got shot, I crawled over and picked him up, and he died in my arms. And I says, my God, I was going to get the SOB that shot him or else die trying. So I picked up my Thompson, and I crisscrossed the hill. I went northeast one way, and then I fired. I had a Thompson submachine gun that I stole out of a Sherman tank that was crippled, and they were waiting for parts to fix it. But the troops that were from the tank were in the farmhouse talking to a farmer, and nobody was in the tank, so I crawled into the tank and pulled out the Thompson submachine gun and left to my rifle. And then I was able to use it on this hill. When I fired it, it fired good straight up, and I says, oh, that's no good either. So I turned it on the side, and I started one left-hand side, and I, and it would automatically move to the right-hand side. That was real great. Mowed down a bunch of bushes, and next thing you know, I was going back and forth. When I go up to one, I fired it, and I turned it over again, and run up the other way, and then throwing it again. The Germans that were from the Seventh Army didn't know about this rocky ledge. And then when they finally got to the top of the rocky ledge, they couldn't see where they could go around it because the rest of the E Company was on the east side of it. They couldn't go there, so they dropped their rifles. I shot 6 of them, I know, but they said I shot 12 of them, and we captured 37 prisoners. They dropped their rifles because they couldn't get past that hill. And then therefore we came back, and we had to go to the left side hill. G Company moved over to the east end hills to chase the Germans off of the east hill down on the east side. And the 100th Battalion team came over and took over the hill 617, the east side of that hill, and then moved up towards the Lost Battalion. And the I Company was catching hell because they were getting shot from one hill and the other hill crossfire. When they finally got it to the Lost Battalion, 150 men, only 7 of them, I Company was able to walk. K Company had 17 men. 100th Battalion had 20 men. We had 30. Arthur, we was on the east side. We didn't get as bad as the others. I got wounded, and I was headed back to the aid station. And I'm the only one there going towards the aid station, and the Germans send up a mortar shell, lands up about 10 feet away from me and picked me up and blew me closer to the aid station. Then I was 3 months in the Epinal Hospital, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And then they finally got me on a plane and went to England.
And up until his dying day in December 2015, he still had shrapnel in his lungs. A souvenir from the Germans, he called it. That was Joe Saccato, one of the Purple Heart heroes of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team's most acclaimed moment, the rescue of the Lost Battalion. It's break time again, but when we come back, what receiving the Medal of Honor more than 50 years after World War II meant to Joe, plus more from his fellow 442 veteran Lawson Sakai, as well as one of the men they helped rescue 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking 75 years since the rescue of the Lost Battalion, a legendary achievement of the Japanese-American soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, freeing between 200 and 300 men from the 36th Infantry Division who had been surrounded by German forces in the Vosges Mountains in France. We'll hear from one of the men who owes his life to that rescue in a moment, but first, more from a man who nearly lost his life in that effort, Medal of Honor recipient Joe Saccato. And I'd like to read you the citation that accompanied the Distinguished Service Cross, which would then be upgraded to our country's top military honor a half century later. Private Saccato distinguished himself by extraordinary heroism in action on 29 October 1944 on Hill 617 in the vicinity of Bifontaine, France. After his platoon had virtually destroyed 2 enemy defense lines, during which he personally killed 5 enemy soldiers and captured 4, his unit was pinned down by heavy enemy fire. Disregarding the enemy fire, Private Saccato made a one-man rush that encouraged his platoon to charge and destroy the enemy strong point. While his platoon was reorganizing, he proved to be the inspiration of his squad in halting a counterattack on the left flank, during which his squad leader was killed. Taking charge of the squad, he continued his relentless tactics, using an enemy rifle and P-38 pistol to stop an organized enemy attack. During this entire action, he killed 12 and wounded 2, personally captured 4, and assisted his platoon in taking 34 prisoners. By continuously ignoring enemy fire, and by his gallant courage and fighting spirit, he turned impending defeat into victory. and helped his platoon complete its mission. Private Sakato's extraordinary heroism and devotion to duty are in keeping with the highest traditions of military service and reflect great credit on him, his unit, and the United States Army. That unit, of course, was the most decorated unit of its size in the entire war, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and Joe's injuries made him part of a catastrophic cost.
During these two battles, Hills 617 and the other hills combined, 800 of us were killed or wounded to rescue 281 men.
That's what I was getting at. You were part of the price that was paid to rescue those soldiers. So there were about three times as many casualties to the Japanese-American soldiers than there were primarily Caucasian soldiers rescued.
That's correct. So I ended up in the hospital, and then I was 7th month I was in Vancouver, Washington hospital, and my kid, younger brother, he sends me a newspaper clipping from hometown of Redlands, California, that George Sakato's classmate of 41 received his Distinguished Service Cross. And he sends me this clipping, and I looked, how does the hometown paper know about me getting the medal, and then I don't know anything about it?
And Joe went on with his life for decades not thinking about the medal. If you lived in the Denver, Colorado area, he may have been your letter carrier. But after a review of military records in the 1990s, it was determined that Joe and other Nisei veterans were denied the Medal of Honor because of prejudice. And in June of 2000, he was in Washington, D.C., receiving America's highest military award from President Bill Clinton.
500 people sitting there. So we finally got everybody in, and then I'm on the stage, and Bill Clinton comes up, and he calls my name, and I get up, and I look at him. I had to look up. He's pretty tall. I got up, and he's putting this on me, and he shakes my hand, and he says, I still couldn't believe that I was getting this Medal of Honor. And I says, no, this doesn't seem right. But like I say, so I wear this not as a hero. I wear this for those who never made it back home. The first day I fell from Washington, gets killed and died, just loss of blood. The other three guys got sniper wounds right next to me, just in arm's length. Three of them got killed. And I wondered, how was it that I'm able to come out of this alive and to be able to receive this medal? I didn't deserve this medal. I was doing what I was supposed to do, my duty. And when I wear this medal, I wear it for those that didn't make it back. And I also wear it for one German that I shot. I went on a patrol, we got down, and we heard this German giving instructions, and the machine gun opens up, and one of the fellows dang near got shot. And I saw this German that was giving the orders, and I shot him, and I shot him in the legs, thighs. He went down, and he saw me. Then he picked up his gun, and when he picked up his gun, I shot him again. I shot him in the groin, and I took off back to our lines, and I hear you screaming and crying for help. And then when I got on top of the hill, our lines, and he's still screaming, and boom. No more screaming. I wonder what happened. Next day we went over and took the hill. I checked on the fellow that I shot. He was in so much pain that he took a grenade and blew himself up, committed suicide. He never went home. So I wear this for him too.
Joe Sakato was such a genuine, humble man, and his words continued to inspire even after his passing 4 years ago at the age of 94. I promised we'd hear from a member of the Lost Battalion, rescued through the courage and sacrifice of Joe Sakato, Lawson Sakai, and so many other go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd, 75 years ago this week. Al Tortolano recently had American Legion Post 419 in Santa Clara, California, renamed in his honor. And there is no question his life was in severe jeopardy 75 years ago this week in the Vosges Mountains, until those men of the 442 broke through.
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it? You know, knowing that I'm never gonna come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh, man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. You figure it was 7 days of what we went through. It was really hell up there because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you had to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh, my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know. And that's why that's one guy that made that remark. When we saw Japanese soldiers, oh, we're fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, really thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it, I felt so bad, because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through, and for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did, I didn't know how to think about it. I just grabbed them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
You talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back? Or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, are you Al Tortolano? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm Lawson Sakai. He says, somebody told me that you were driving. He said, I was with the 442nd. Oh, my God. He says, is there any chance we can get together and talk? I says, oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, we started talking, and that's how I started getting involved with the 442nd. From there, they started inviting me to their different functions. I went to their reunions in Las Vegas as their guest. They made me an honorary member of the 442nd, and we got to swap stories, and I got to meet so many wonderful people.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt, not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, thinking, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning, you know. I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors. And they deserve every little hello or thank you that they can get.
And in 2011, they received another big thank you. All Nisei veterans of World War II were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal, the complete opposite end of the spectrum from the way Americans of Japanese ancestry were treated 70 years earlier. Let's get a final piece of perspective today from the Purple Heart and Bronze Star recipient we heard from earlier, Lawson Sakai.
Well, you know, the whole country is formed by immigrants. So it's pretty hard to say one group of immigrants can say we're American, but you immigrants are not Americans. It, you know, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that correction was a huge step in forming the United States. It's just something that had to be recognized. And in 1941, this whole country was run by the East Coast people. And a lot of those people, including President Roosevelt, had very little knowledge or contact with Asian people at that point, because almost all of us were on the West Coast, and East Coasters didn't want to mingle with the savages on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, it was like, oh, those animals out in the West Coast, you know. So I think the war did bring both sides together. East went west, west went east, and things changed a lot. I think we did what we intended to do. I'm sorry that, like my parents and all the other Issei who are now all gone, didn't really live long enough to capitalize on what we had gotten for them. 1952, I believe, they were allowed to become naturalized citizens of the United States. You know, a huge turnaround from deportation to naturalization, you know, and all because of what their children, the Nisei boys, did for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is very important to impress on, like, my children and their children, that they know that that first generation that was born here suffered along with their parents because they couldn't get jobs either. But by doing what they did, going to war and so forth, they, you know, they created the life for them that's so good.
Yeah.
Like, I have four children. They all graduated college. They're all doing good. I have seven grandchildren. They've all graduated college, and they're all doing good. You know, you couldn't have done that in 1941.
Well, none of them would have been born if you didn't survive the war. But, you know, I always end the show by saying freedom isn't free. And what you're saying is, for Japanese Americans, freedom and opportunity isn't free, that a lot of lives paid for it in World War II.
Absolutely. Well, we've had a couple of generations since that have never had to go to war. And in 1941 and 2, the whole world was at war. We were either going to win or lose. And if we lost, we'd either be speaking German or Japanese today.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, you had to either win or lose.
And aren't we all thankful they won? That is Lawson Sakai. Happy 96th birthday, Lawson. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a lot more pleasant than that 21st birthday spent in the push to rescue the Lost Battalion 75 years ago this week. A reminder, there are photos and links posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com, including those two events I mentioned at the top of the program. I really hope you can make it if you're in those areas. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, telling you one more time that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.